Hi, this is Amanda Tapping, and I played Helen Magnus in Sanctuary. And you are listening to Women Talk Sci-Fi.
Hi, this is Jerry Donaldson.
And Eugenia Stapiro. And you are listening to
Women Talk Sci-Fi. Welcome back to another episode.
Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Eugenia. How are you? We record podcasts in batches. We look down, we do the work, we sit there, and for some reason or another, we've had a bit recorded, so we haven't done this for a little bit. So we're getting back into the flow.
Yeah, because we're a little bit making a few more errors than we normally do.
Yes, well, you usually, when you've done podcasting for a while, have actually, you know, got into, you know what your standard sort of variation of your greeting is and so on, and we're losing it.
We are losing it. However, we haven't lost it with this particular TV show.
No, not at all. Well, it's been around almost as long or longer than us, one or the other, you know. So it's a show and it's an English TV show, or United Kingdom.
And it has a little blue box
in it. And it has a little blue box in it. And we have so many things to talk about it. You can just go on and on and on. But this day we're not talking about New Who.
No, we're talking about Old Who.
Old Who. And we're having a wonderful interview later on with someone who was an Old Who.
But he was young when he was in the Old Who.
Yes, he's not quite old now, but he is a little bit older than he was when he appeared in. And he was quite iconic at the time.
So we're talking about Matthew Waterhouse, who played Adric.
And his doctor was?
The fifth doctor, your favourite.
Yes, Peter Davison is my favourite doctor. I mean, I really enjoyed, and I've said this to Peter, if you go back and listen to an interview that we did with him, that I loved Doctor Who, but when he came along, I loved Doctor Who. So he's my doctor.
I think I've come to appreciate the Fifth Doctor's era as I've watched it more and more in later life. I don't think I enjoyed it as much when I was watching
so
it.
Cute.
Oh, he was cute.
After everybody else, he was as cute as, and I really liked the sassy chick.
What, Tegan?
Tegan. I liked the fact there was a sassy girl.
I liked her more because she was Australian.
Well, I lived in Australia when that episode's come out, but I loved All Creatures Great and Small, so that actually warmed me to him. The fact that in the 1980s, when we watched it, it was an era, if you're a certain age, of women coming to the fore in some of the aspects. Tegan, to me, was an icon of that sort of a woman who knew her own mind and did all those things.
And in fact, we had two women in the TARDIS during that time because there was also Nyssa, who was a mathematician.
So there were smart, sassy women hanging around. So that's why I probably think of you know, Doctor Number Five as my doctor.
And Adric, of course, was extremely smart too and was also mathematically inclined.
He was from a medieval type era. In terms of coming into, so he was coming out of the past into the future, as opposed to some of the other girls who were currently in now.
True, but he also came from another planet.
Yes, he did come from another planet. Well, they all come from different planets. We have Gallifrey, and of course we have Adric from?
I don't know. I can only just remember the swamp people from
his
swamp
people,
particular
yes.
it
was
planet.
Very medieval in his little dressy thing that he wore right at the beginning, his tunic.
His tunic and his little blue star. The thing about Adric, he was the first, well, he wasn't actually the first one that sacrificed himself.
He was one of the youngest ones, though, wasn't he? He was the mop-haired teen.
Yes, he was.
And he was probably one of Doctor Who's first attempts at St. Susan, of having a very young person in the TARDIS.
That's very true. And he also was a stowaway. So it wasn't the Doctor inviting him to come into the TARDIS. He wanted to follow the Doctor.
And I think it was probably the attempt in the 1980s to get Doctor Who back with young people.
Well, we had Sarah Jane there for quite a while. And I mean, it's not like she was old, but
no,
she was in her mid-20s. So you had an older woman compared to the three that were there. And Adric was the little smart ass. He was like the Wesley.
The Wesley of Star Trek.
Yes. And a lot of
I didn't want to smack Adric as much as I want to smack Wesley.
And you know, you talk to some people, and some people don't talk about Adric fondly.
No.
They don't like him that much as a character. But as I said, since going back and watching older episodes, I really do like Adric. And the fact that he gave up his life to save
everybody,
including the whole of the Earth with the Cybermen, it was amazing. And the way they ended that particular program was quite amazing too. You know, it went down on the crushed star and there was no Doctor Who theme playing. It was just very silent with the credits going up. So that particular show, that ending, showed that there was something quite special that had happened during that time. But as I said, it's not the first time that a companion's actually given their life up, because Sarah Kingdom did. No. And last time was
William Hartnell. And Donna metaphorically did.
Later, yes.
With David Tennant, metaphorically, not real, because, of course, she's still her. But not happened. Most of them just leave.
They do. Well, that's that, I think, because it was such a significant
difference
that he was, you know, going to basically kill himself. I think that really did mean a lot. And I still remember watching it, I think, when it first went on. And I was, you know, not that old. And it did sort of touch me. I mean, it's like, no, you can't do that. You know, Doctor Who people don't die. Well, Daleks exterminate people all the time.
Who cares?
But companions don't
die. Yes. So he probably was the first real one to die?
Well, as I said, Sarah Kingdom did, but she technically is sometimes classed as a companion and isn't. She came onto the TARDIS, but she didn't travel with the Doctor as such, and she did.
So she's not a real one.
So she's not, I wouldn't class her as really a real one. But, you know, if you want to get picky, you could say she was the first one.
And someone will get picky. It happens out there.
But Matthew's lovely. I mean, he is such a nice man to talk to, and we had a wonderful time interviewing him.
Well, we were also lucky enough not just to interview him. We were lucky to have a friend who runs conventions sometimes, and we got to spend most of the day with him and some of the other wonderful companions from the time. So we're very lucky, and in particular we'd like to thank for this time, for this interview, is Scott Liston from First Contact Conventions. And you can find them at
www.firstcontactconventions.com.au.
And they bring the Intimate Corner around Australia, which is fantastic. I love the Intimate Corner as opposed to the big, you know,
Expo
kind of con, Supernova, Comic Con. They're fantastic, but sometimes it's nice to get up close and personal. And Matthew was very entertaining when he came along. And he really loves his role.
He does.
And he has a book out.
He has to have and it's also an audio book as well, and it's called The Boy in the Blue Box. The Little Boy in the Blue Box. No, what's it called?
Blue Box Boy.
Okay, there we go.
I'm pretty sure it's called The Blue Box Boy. And, of course, he's written other works. He's an author as well as an actor. So if you're interested in contemporary fiction, then have a look at Matthew's own site, which is matthewwaterhouse.com, and you'll be able to find out some of his books there.
So let's listen to his interview. Matthew, it's great to have you here in Australia. Thank you for coming all this way.
Great to be here.
Now, you've always been a long-time Doctor Who fan before you even got onto the show.
Yes.
So, who was your Doctor?
Oh, they were all my Doctors, really. I liked them all. I didn't see William Hartnell until I was an adult. I was too young for this. So, the first Doctor I saw was Patrick. So, Patrick, John and Tom were the Doctors that I always dashed home for. Once I knew about it, I always watched it. So, the first programme I didn't see were ones I was in, because often we were in the studio on a Saturday, so there were some Saturdays when I actually couldn't see the programmes I was in, but until then I watched all of them, and I've always regarded them as all as my Doctors, John, Patrick and Tom.
So when you came on the set, you basically knew what the TARDIS console was?
Oh, I knew. I knew that.
You could just do it all.
Oh, yes, I knew.
It was ingrained.
It's ingrained there, yes, oh yes. Oh, if that button does that, yes. That's TARDIS. Actually, I wrote in my book, Blue Box Boy, I wrote about the first time I stood on the TARDIS set. It was just wonderful. It was a magical. Because it wasn't lit. Tom and a couple of actors were doing another scene the other end of the studio. So there was a set down the bottom of the studio lit. But where I was, it was dark. So I just walked around the TARDIS console in the dark, pulling the levers and touching it. It was just an amazing. No, it was just a magical moment the first time I stood on that set.
Now, what age were you when you first got there?
Into Doctor Who, 18.
Into Doctor 18. Was it your first acting job?
No, I'd done a serial for the BBC called A Servant All My Days, and that led me into Doctor Who.
And was acting something that you'd always wanted to do?
Yes, oh yes, yes. Yeah, I'd always wanted to be an actor. Well, as far back as I can remember, I'd always wanted to be an actor, yes.
And you started, did you go through RADA, or how did
I just left school and fell into Doctor Who, fell into To Serve More My Days, and then into Doctor Who. It just happened really fast. It was really bizarre and surreal, but it just, the way sometimes things in life just sort of click and they seem inexplicably just linked together in the right way. So it was absolutely bizarre how quickly everything fell into place.
So on job training, definitely.
Oh, God, yes.
Was it quite daunting? I mean,
oh, it was terrifying, yes. So it's very exciting, but it was terrifying, yes.
So reading a script, did you think any idea of what you were going to do? Or did you just think, I have to read this out loud?
Oh, well, as an actor, I always read aloud. I read scripts the minute they arrive. I read them through, but I start articulating them all the time. I mean, probably every actor does. I mean, when you're working aloud anyway, you start working aloud as soon as you can. But I loved it. One of my favourite moments, favourite sort of elements of Doctor Who throughout my time was receiving the new script. It was always, because I really had always loved the programme, and you'd make a story, you'd have a 2-week break, and then the next script would flop onto the mat, and I'd tear it out of the envelope and start reading. It was always tremendously exciting. Each script arriving was a really exciting thing.
Because it was fairly pressurised, wasn't it? Your rehearsal time and then your filming time, it was go, 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 go all the time.
Well, we were talking to Katie about this. Katie, I think, was much more pressured. With Katie, they used to record episodes. They used to rehearse them, but then record them as live. So, literally, you know, one episode, apart from the filmed bits, they would be walking from set to set to set, recording it in order. Whereas what we did is we recorded set by set. So all the TARDIS scenes in a four-part story were recorded at one time, all the scenes of another set recorded another time, all the scenes of another set recorded another time. Now, 10 days rehearsal, do the first batch of recording. If there was filming, it was done before the rehearsal, but it wasn't always filming. But then, so we'd do the 3 studio days, and then we would have another 10 days rehearsal, and then do the last 3 studio days, doing all the other sets, the sets that we hadn't recorded the first bunch. And at the end of the month, they've got all the material, and then just sort of glue it together and turn it into a serial.
So was that sort of a change in the way that filming was beginning to be done?
I don't know when they... I don't think Tom ever did the recorded... I don't think Tom ever did it where they did it in order, like Katie did. I think by then it had changed. I think they were doing it the way they did it when I was in it, by the time Tom came along, I think.
So did that make it harder to sort of put yourself in that scene, seeing that you were jumbling all over the place and you didn't have continuation?
Well, you would make notes about it, so you would... You'd have to be aware of what had happened in the previous scene, even if you haven't recorded it yet, and what context the scene that you were doing was in. Yeah, you did have to be aware of that. Hard, I can't honestly say it's that hard. I mean, you know, you write it on the script, you try and keep tabs with it. So, not hard. I mean, actually, 10 days rehearsal, or 20 days rehearsal in total for a story, is quite a lot of rehearsal for something like Doctor Who, where you're not exploring character. You know, if you're doing Shakespeare, that's not very much rehearsal. Because there's so much to explore and argue about and so many different approaches to it you can discuss. With Doctor Who, it's fairly fixed. I think Peter tended to think we had too much rehearsal, actually. Tom, of course, used to rewrite a lot, because one of the things, when you've got 10 days rehearsal and there's not that much to rehearse, what do? You just sit around changing the script. So... It fills up the day.
And do the crossword puzzle.
And do the crossword puzzle. Yeah, a lot of Doctor Who actors were big on crossword. I'm rubbish at crosswords. I've never got any good at them. Which is odd, because I'm quite a word person, and yet crosswords I just can't do. But lots of actors do crosswords, yes. There were certainly crossword puzzles being done all over the rehearsal room.
Is it... I suppose I'm asking the question. You see a programme on television, because obviously Doctor Who's been around forever. And it's part of your psyche almost, and particularly the UK psyche, Doctor Who, and then you're in it. Which is more fun, watching it or actually being in it?
Well, they're so different. I mean, but in my case, I mean, you're right about it being a part of the psyche. It's very much part of my psyche. It was, you know, I think Patrick Troughton would have been the first actor I could name, is my guess. So it's very much in my psyche. It's very much a big part of my imaginative life, you know, because I read all Terence's Target books and I bought the thing called TV comic that had the Doctor Who two-page
comics.
Yeah, so do I. Actually, fab, you know. I love that. This guy called John Canning drew them. He did fantastic Patrick Troughton. It was just wonderful. So I gobbled up all that stuff. It was very much a part of my psyche. But when you're working on it, it is obviously your perspective becomes entirely different. And afterwards, when you watch it afterwards, once you know the way it's done, you understand. I mean, if I watch a Colin Baker episode or a Silver episode, I knew exactly what they were doing. I knew exactly what it was like doing it. I knew what the way... I probably actually knew the guy behind the camera. They were mainly the same people. I knew what the set looked like. I knew what it was like to touch the set. So your perspective is entirely different. It's entirely different. But it is just a wonderful thing to be a part of something, to become a sort of ingrained part of a material that you really, really liked and admired. So it's tremendously exciting.
So how hard or easy was it to go through a regeneration?
Oh, well, a regeneration was such an iconic thing. I mean, it's... And I was in two of them. I think Janet, Sarah and I are the only companions to have done two of them. Because, of course, Tom into Peter and then Peter into Colin, we all came back as floating heads, if you remember. That's beautiful. I saw the Caves of Androzani last year at the BFI, which is Film Institute, where they showed the old episodes as part of the 50th anniversary celebration. Caves of Androzani is absolutely stunning piece of pop drama. It's a stunning piece. But that regeneration is unbelievably good. And it's funny because there was some comedy program, I didn't see it, but some comedy program in Britain where they were talking about the 50 worst moments in television or something, and some guy selected the regeneration of Tom into Peter as one of the 50 worst moments in television, which is ridiculous. It's not even one of the 50 worst moments in Logopolis. but they did on this program. But I still think the Caves of Androzani regeneration is possibly the most exciting regeneration ever. I think it's just beautifully incredible. And of course for me it is a very iconic part of the Doctor Who myth. The idea that he sort of falls on the floor and then his face sort of goes all blurry and suddenly he's different. Doing regenerations was fab, and I was really glad to have done two of them.
Was it daunting then to think of a different Doctor? A different direction for the show?
Not daunting. Probably it's daunting for the Doctor. I'm sure it's daunting for Peter. I'm sure it's daunting for Colin. But, no, it's interesting, I would say. Rather than daunting, it's interesting.
Because it changes the whole timbre of the show.
Oh, it absolutely does, yeah, you're right. The whole texture changes.
It's the same person, but they're different.
Yeah, the character is entirely different. The temperament of the character is different. Not he looks different, but he behaves differently. I mean, everything becomes different.
Did you have to consider your relationship then with that new Doctor in a different way?
You did, yes, to an extent. Though, you know, the relationship between the Doctors and the Companions... It changes, but there's also a lot of it remains the same. I mean, the Doctor-Companion relationship is a sort of, we understand what that relationship is. And even though there can be variations within that relationship, it's a fairly continuous thing. It remains sort of similar. I love the relationship between Patrick T. Nissa and the Fifth Doctor. I think it's one of the really... the most interesting TARDIS crews in those terms.
It's a crowded
TARDIS. But they relate to it. They're quite difficult to define, those characters, and they relate to each other in quite a... I wouldn't say complex, but they're quite interesting. They're quite hard to define. The relationship between Adric and Teague and the one between Adric and Miss and the one between Adric and Doctor are sort of slightly different. And I think the old Doctor was better on character than people remember it being. They tend to think that, you know, that it was very sort of simple in character terms, but it wasn't necessarily. And I think that the Fifth Doctor crew is really quite interestingly done by Eric Saywood and the other writers.
Well, so is
Tom's. I mean, I think the relationship between Adric and the Fourth Doctor is absolutely wonderful, particularly in The Keeper of Traken. And again, it's subtler than you think. There are more interesting notes in it than you might immediately think. Oh, Doctor and Companion Boy, well, that's pretty obvious, isn't it? I think there are more interesting notes in it than sometimes people realise.
Because writing for so many people and keeping it interesting is difficult, but they seem to manage that quite well in the Fifth Doctor.
Yeah, I think they really did. But of course, it started that way. It was a return, very much, I think a conscious choice. I think John Langton was aware that that's the way it had been in 1963, that it was the Doctor, Susan, his granddaughter, and Ian and Barbara. So that's the way it started. And I think it was a very conscious reference to that beginning, the idea of the four of them travelling around.
Now, you've said you love words, but you've actually written quite a number of books now, haven't you?
I have, yes. I wrote a memoir about Dr. Who called Blue Box Boy. I've written three novels, a couple of short stories.
The novels. Tell us about the novels, genre and so on.
The novels are sort of slightly fantastical black comedies set in and around New York. Faith Flowers, Vanitas, and the newest one, Precious Liars. They're about people's interior lives, the way they relate to each other, romantic lives, but with a sort of stylized, fantastical quality to them. They're not science fiction exactly, but this sort of urban does fantasy. Dreamlike. Yes, but fantasy not in the sort of Tolkien sense of elves and hobbits, but yes, there is a fantastical quality to them. One of them is about a woman whose paintings, she's a professional artist, but her paintings begin to change. They begin to sort of take on a life of their own. So that's the sort of what I'm pursuing, the sort of sense of the world as being these characters who are heightened but sort of real and behave in real ways. They occupy this world that's slightly tilted, slightly different from our world. It's supernatural, it's slightly more of a presence, a slightly more haunting thing.
So did you always want to be a writer?
I always wanted to be, but it very much is related to the acting. It's something, I mean, my books are very much books that they're very much the kind of writing actors do. Apart from that, a lot of the characters are artists of one kind or another. I mean, The Precious Liars has an actor character in it, a painter, a theatre producer, a poet. So there are a lot of artists of different kinds in the novels. And also because as an actor I speak aloud, but also as a writer I do. When I'm working on the text, I speak the dialogue so that I can hear the characters speaking. It's really important to me to be able to hear the rhythms of the characters and the descriptive elements as well. And of course, they're done as audiobooks as well, so they do actually take on a performance life. So to that extent, they relate to acting as well. It's all sort of one life. I regard it all as one thing.
So in that case, if you do an audio of your own work as opposed to doing acting of others' words, is it different?
It's different in the sense that I know why the sentence is written. I don't have to work out why I chose to write the sentences in those particular rhythms because I wrote them. I thought about them and I made them because of the way they sounded and the images they create. So to that extent, if I go and read it, I've lived with. By the time my publisher takes me into a studio to record them, I've lived with the text for a very long time. I mean, a couple of years. So yeah, I go in there knowing exactly how it should sound. How the characters speak to each other.
Because voice acting is completely different from acting. There are some actors who are rubbish at reading a book and doing it. It's almost like a different kind of way.
It's a particular skill or a particular facility, I think, that some people find fairly easy and some people find really, really difficult.
Because you have to bring a character to life just through sound.
Yes, yes. I mean, I love doing Doctor Who audiobooks. Because I was a big Doctor Who fan, I read all the Target books up until I was cast in Doctor Who. So now that I've been actually employed to read Target books, to sit in a plush studio reading Target books, I have to tell you, it's really cool. And you get to play all the characters. I mean, that's just... If you like that sort of thing, then it's very cool. I mean, I've now not only played Adric many times, but I've played...
You've been a Doctor.
I've been the fifth Doctor, I've been the fourth Doctor, I've been Romana, I've been Nyssa and Tegan, and I've been a comedy highwayman, and I've been a monstrous pterolectal, you know, who's trying to... to destroy London with the plague and all that stuff, and so yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. Actually, getting to play every part of Doctor Who. Tom always said he didn't like it when people cut away from him. He said, "I don't know what are all these other characters doing in the TARDIS? They're cutting away from me. I don't like that." And what I love is that with an audio, but they can't cut away from you because when they cut to the next character, oh, it's still you. I expect Tom's dream come true. I love it. I love the fact that I get to do the fourth Doctor. It's just wonderful. It's just, they're great fun. And you do we do them really fast. I mean, I've done Full Circle, which comes out in January, and I did The Visitation. And we do them in a day. I mean, The Visitation, which is 3 hours, 3.5 hours of recorded material, we recorded it in the studio in about 4 hours.
Oh, wow.
So it's very exciting.
So it's really almost live.
It's fairly near to being live, yeah. Going to the studio. We started at 10:30, left at 3:30, had a lunch break for an hour, drank some coffee and stuff. And so we're actually sitting in the studio for 4 hours and doing it, almost no retake.
So what's the challenge then of doing a big Finnish production as opposed to an audiobook? I love audiobooks. I listen to them constantly. And having someone that's read them is quite nice. How do you do them? Do you actually read a bit and stop and change voice? Or do you do it consecutively, like do you do character, character, character?
Oh no, you start with chapter one and read through to the end.
You read the whole book, so you do it as if...
Absolutely, chapter one to chapter ten, whatever.
So when you're reading it, you're, for instance, Doctor Who, and then you're Adric, and you just have to change your voice?
Yes, yes, yes.
Right then, oh wow.
Yeah,
that even makes it much more difficult. To
actually,
me,
yeah.
Person doing it, I mean, how do you in fact then get the idea of the sound of people's voices.
Well, yeah, you do. I look at the book for a week or so before the recording, so I spend quite a lot of time thinking of the voices and practicing. And again, I would have read it aloud in our house before I would go to the student read aloud. So that's not the first time I've actually read the entire text aloud with my voice. So I do know what it's going to come out like. But I think it's absolutely wonderful. And of course, with Doctor Who, a lot of the characters are fixed. You know, okay, I don't have Tom's voice, but I have a sense of Tom's rhythm. And so I am, it's not impersonation exactly, but I am sketching a familiar character. When I do Adric, I'm sketching a character familiar to listeners. The non-regular characters are an opportunity to be a bit madder, you know. Interestingly, in The Visitation, the character of the Highwayman is not Michael Robbins. In the novel, the character that's described is not the actor who played it on television. So there, you don't even have to try and make it sound like the television guy, because that's not what Eric Saywood in the novel was doing. He clearly had a different view of that Highwayman character. So then you can go completely mad, and you can do your old... And of course, because he's a really old... That character's a really old ham actor of a sort of Victorian kind. Pre-Victorian, that sort of really old sort of... actor, so you can just go mad at that. It's just great fun. They're great fun. I really love doing
them. And I love listening to them. But how do you come up with a different voice?
Well, you're an actor. You just do it.
Sorry.
Actually, no, Katie's right. She's just done kind of a monsters, by the way.
Katie's just crashed the interview.
Yeah, the interview.
Katie, sorry, no.
I wasn't here.
No, you were. Yeah, come on.
Well, come and sit down. Yeah, come and listen. It's very interesting. I've got many more interesting things to say. But yeah, so well, you somehow I think the cat you just it comes. You read it. You have a sense of who the character is, and somehow the voice comes. The ideal is quite difficult. I mean, Full Circle has about 20 characters in it, and I think The Visitation does too. So it's sort of quite difficult to make every voice completely different, because you do have the, I mean, whatever I do with my voice, it is the voice I've got. But the ideal is that when a character speaks, the listener knows who's speaking before the text says, said Tegan or said the Doctor.
Yes.
The element of differentiation, that so people know who it is.
So when you have 20 characters then, how do you maintain that character set, you know, of the 20 different voices that you actually have?
So you don't forget who's who.
Well, I scrawl little notes, actually. The big secret is we don't actually, even though when we're photographed reading, we're sitting there holding a little target book.
Yeah.
Big secret is we don't actually read from the target book. we read from photocopy pages, with which we scrawl writing all over. So if I've decided a voice has a certain timbre, then I will note it by every time, particularly a small part character, a character that comes in with once every 50 pages where you might easily forget. I actually mark one or two notes so that when I get back to the character, I remember exactly how I tried to make him sound 50 pages earlier. But they're great. But yeah, Big Finish, of course, is entirely different. Big Finish is radio acting. It's a different thing from reading a book. A lot of people think, because it's audio, because it's sort of the same category, that it's sort of the same job. In fact, it is entirely different when you're back in the studio acting with Peter and Janet.
So you say that in Big Finish it is an actual play, so they do the sound effects even while you're there?
No, they're put on. They're put on later. But all of the... No, not the Dark Shadows. I did a Dark Shadows recently where not all the actors were in the studio. But the Doctor Who, we tend to do them in order. So, again, it's not like on the television series where we did all the TARDIS scenes all at once.
Yes.
The Doctor Who's I've done, we tend to actually do them scene by scene in order. So it sort of unfolds naturally, like a play does. But the effects and so forth are put on later, the director and his cronies get their hands on it.
Take your work and then manipulate it their way.
Yeah.
So how was it when DVDs started to come out and they were doing the commentaries to episodes, and I guess a lot of you had not seen each other for a long time apart from conventions, coming back and then having to talk about something that you had done, you know, a number of years ago?
Yeah, well, they're sort of larky. I'm not sure about the commentary. I don't really like DVD commentaries on other things. I mean, when I've listened to them, I think, you know, listening to a writer laughing at his own jokes isn't all that interesting. And but I think the Doctor Who ones are quite lively and fun. I don't know that they're very revealing or interesting, to be absolutely honest, but they're fun to do. Some people prepare. I think Peter watches them. I'm pretty sure he watches them before he does the commentaries. I could be wrong, but I think he does. But I don't. I like the idea of just turning up at the thing and seeing it for the first time in 5 years or even 20 years, however long it might be. So there's a sort of a variety. There's a sort of expert who said, oh, yes, this next shot, something's going to happen. And then there's sort of people like me and I think Katie sort of saying, oh, I completely forgot that. Whoa, what's that? What is that? Oh, look, it's a booming shot.
So do they have that sort of playing in front of you and you just talk?
Yes, you sit, you sit at a little
glass of
table.
Wine.
Oh, I wish. But, though, we did actually have cups of tea. We sit with cups of tea. And we make slurping noises
very
to give
British.
So people know. Yes, very British. It'd be interesting to do it if we had a bottle of wine. As well. That would add a bit of quality.
I think they should have R-rated ones, that you could put out. Yes.
Well, actually, on the first few, I swore, not in a very bad way, but I was like, bloody hells kind of stuff. But then they decided, when they did the new programme, they decided that really young children might start listening to these things. So then they said, you can't swear, you can't even say bloody anymore. So they actually changed the rule halfway through the doing of the commentaries. They actually changed the rule about that.
Does that make it more difficult then to be spontaneous?
What, when you can't say that was bloody awful?
What did I do there?
Oh, yes, you have to be a bit more careful. Yes. But yeah, you know, you sit and watch it, though the first time, for some reason, if you have four, they have these little sort of viewing thing, and then they have the microphone coming down, and there are only about one or two chairs where you can actually see the whole of the screen. So for the rest of us, we're watching with a microphone slashed halfway across it.
Gee.
So really, you are actually not seeing the entire thing. You're only seeing a portion of the screen.
Do you fight for the chairs then?
Well,
or is there a seniority? It
has to be said. When the doctor rolls in, there probably is a seniority. Yes. But when the doctor's not there, they're a bit more egalitarian in that we all just dash for the best seats and elbow each other out of the way until we get there.
I've seen the TARDIS longer than you.
I've been a fan longer than you.
Yes.
So your books, Matthew, where can people get those?
My publisher's called Head Music. And you can get it directly. I've got a website which has, MatthewWaterhouse.com, which actually has a little shop. Not that I'm personally selling them or anything, but there's a little shop that would link you to the publisher. So all of my books can now be, if you just go to my website, you can find all of my books. And you can, actually, I think there's a link now for the Abject Box set of Big Finish as well, and the Full Circle. There's a pre-order thing for the Full Circle.
iTunes? You sell them on iTunes?
Not at the moment.
I don't think the audio books... I mean, I don't actually... It's not my decision.
It's not the publisher.
It's the publisher, really. But I don't think they're on iTunes. The books, I think, are available on download as well as physically. But obviously, the best way of reading a book is to have a physical book with paper that you open and you sit and read on the train.
Well, not according to the person sitting across from you here.
I am an audio book. I probably read 10 to 15 a week.
Audiobooks. Oh, no, I like audiobooks. No, I was thinking
I
more of the Nook.
The Kindle.
Yes. Because you can do two things at once. You can clean the toilet and read a book, and it doesn't seem so bad.
No, it doesn't, exactly.
You know, it's much more
interesting. Life can go on, and yet you're still...
enjoying it.
I've been listening to quite a lot of Big Finish since I started working for them. Because I've done Dark Shadows for them. I've heard a lot of the Dark Shadows series, and I really do enjoy, actually really like the vibe of putting on this CD and listening to this thing while pottering about doing a bit of dusting or something.
You can clean the garden and everything, and sit on the train and you can be in a different world.
I like it. And another thing was Sapphire and Steel. David Richardson gave me a set of Sapphire and Steel, because it's a program I always liked. Do you know Sapphire and Steel?
I love Sapphire and Steel.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, David McCallum.
Everything in that era has on
Joanna Lumley.
Australian television.
Yeah,
the ABC is...
It's a wonderful thing.
It is a fantastic show. People, I don't think, really know about it much.
No, they don't. I don't think it didn't sell over here, did it? It wasn't actually broadcast here?
It was broadcast here,
on the ABC.
But it wasn't repeated like Doctor Who was.
Yes,
right.
I remember watching it.
Mm. Well,
Joanna and David.
It's a very strange and inventive, very idiosyncratic show.
Yes.
And Big Finish did 15 of their own stories with Joanna Harker and David Warner. And they're brilliant, Steele and Sam. They're both absolutely brilliant in it. And the stories are very much in the style of the series without just being pastiche. And I'm really impressed by them. And they're still in print. It's still obtainable. But they're very worth hearing. I agree with that. I like the sense of listening to drama. And it is more intimate than watching something, in the sense of just these voices unfolding it. I think this is a very enjoyable thing. I'm really quite taken by it.
But we must finish.
Yes.
A big finish. So, thank you so much for your time, Matt.
It's been wonderful. Oh, and just a little bit of plugging. Don't forget Full Circle audiobook in January and Bloodlust, Dark Shadows Bloodlust from Big Finish. It's a Dark Shadows serial, which I'm in, and which I think is absolutely bad. And they're doing it in serial form, so it's 13 half-hour episodes. And when you order it, you get the CDs and everything, of course. But the idea is, first of all, you listen to it on download Tuesday and Friday. So you have the old-fashioned experience of listening to a serial over a period of weeks. It's quite a big new venture for Big Finish, so it's something they've not done before, and I think it's good. The scripts are fantastic, and it's going to be really good. So I hope people will give Dark Shadows Bloodlust a listen when it comes up in January.
Fantastic.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, this is John Noble, and I played a few things, but you might remember me as Walter Bishop in Fringe. You are listening to Women Talk Sci-Fi.
We have a special little extra on this podcast.
We do.
So don't hang finish yet. Even though Matthew's gone away and the interview's finished and it took a long time, you need to listen to this bit. This is about who's not on who.
Now, to give you the backstory to this, we interviewed Rupert Young, and he played...
Who is Rupert Young?
He played Sir Leon in Merlin.
And he was one of the main characters in it, and we were very lucky to be able to get to interview him. However...
Yes. I tend to look up the IMDb of a person.
Well, you like to collect autographs.
I do, particularly of Doctor Who people, because I like to put them on my poster. And
she has this more than just a poster. She has numerous posters that we have decided whether it's going to be a triptych, which is three, or whatever a 5-1 is, or whatever Quintich. A 7-1, or a 1,432,001.
And I looked up his IMDb, and according to his IMDb, he was in Doctor Who, and he was a Roman soldier in the episode of the Pandora's Box, which is with Matt Smith. So I went up, and it's still in there.
And I've just looked up IMDb, and it actually says it's still there. It says he played a Roman in the Pandora Opens.
Mm-hmm. So I went up to his table and said, oh, I don't see any Doctor Who pictures, because I'd like to get a Doctor Who one signed. And he says, but I've never been in Doctor Who.
He said, yes, you have. She actually did say, yes, you have. It's on your IMDb.
So the next day...
We got to interview him, lucky enough, and we knew we were going to interview him the next day.
But I also made up a particular photo, which had a photo of the person who was supposed to be him.
Gee, well, here's it. Does look like Rupert Young.
Well, he thought I'd photoshopped the photo of him into a Roman soldier's helmet. And then I put the IMDb little thing, and then I put Doctor Who, and then he wrote all over it saying...
This is not me.
I'm not in Doctor Who. And so most of our interview wasn't about Merlin.
It was about Doctor Who. So we actually ended up decided to put him in a Doctor Who podcast. So don't go away. Have a listen to us discuss about what an actor didn't do.
That was a great start.
So did you fluff your lines many times?
I did, as you can see. I only read the top two and then went, the other two can't be that important. So that's a good start, isn't it? It's really good.
Just don't want to miss out on their lines.
I just think the less is more. Less is more. I do it all with the eyes.
Which is why you're an uncredited Roman in Doctor.
That is why. They were.
Less is more.
Less is more. So much less is that I'm not in it at all. It was. That's how little I did in it, and I think the power of my performance was extraordinary.
It was.
Well, yeah. It's worldwide that your picture's out there saying you were in Doctor Who.
I know, and it fooled me. I can't believe I did such a pathetic amount of work and still managed to be in a show that I don't remember, and a successful one. Of all the shows I don't remember or didn't do to be in, Doctor Who's the best one to not but be in, if that makes any sense.
But Merlin was a very successful show.
Merlin was, yeah, and I was in
5 years for a British television show is quite significant. 5 years in a row in particular.
Yeah, of course. I think they always hoped it would be popular, obviously, like every show. And they always had a five-year vision. But to actually do 5 years and get better and bigger every year, I think, you know, and see how popular it is. Even, you know, 2 years after we finished, it's coming out here and going around the world and a lot of places you go to. It's so, so popular. It's amazing.
Did you have any experience in the geek world before Merlin?
I had friends who'd been in Doctor Who and who had actually been in Doctor Who.
Tom Hopper for a start.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I knew people I kind of knew of it and the fantasy thing, and but I didn't quite know how big a thing it was. You know, the Star Wars, and I think everyone knows. I don't think there's anyone I know who hasn't at some point had a little geekdom or whatever the or fandom in them. You know, I was a huge Star Wars fan growing up, and I mean that and my nephews are 3 and 6. You know, they are obsessed with Star Wars, and now and it's amazing to see shows like that just keep getting bigger and bigger. And Doctor Who, that for years that people are so interested in it,
and even though you haven't been in it.
But then one day I will be, and yeah, I auditioned for it once, not for Roman Soldier. it's amazing. I mean, I would say you do look around and you see the excitement, the fandoms, and how brilliant it is. You know, it's another great part of why the show is so popular.
So was Merlin the Knights going to be as significant as they became?
I don't think so. I think what happened, I mean, for me especially, I was only meant to be in 2 scenes. And I auditioned for 2 knights. One was Sir Leon and one was Sir Made Up, Sir Roman Soldier.
Uncredited.
And luckily they went, can you play Sir Leon? And then the other guy got, he was in it, but he was killed and was played by a stuntman. And then they went, oh, we like what you do. Could you say a few more things? Could you do a bit more? And then it just kept getting me back. And then the fans really liked me because I think I was the first knight who said something. And then before you know it, you're suddenly doing a bit more and a bit more. And then they go, could you come back for most of this next series? And I was like, I thought I died in the second one, but that's fine. I'll definitely come back.
It's
and then
so
it's great. Yeah.
So you don't die.
You die. You never do. And then the next time I came back, and then the time, and then it became this huge thing. And so I kind of, yeah, Sir Leon's not in the legend, but there's a, I kind of hoped that the round table, I knew the round table were coming into it at some point, and it was great to, I had no dream, I had no idea when I auditioned that I would be 5 years, 6 years later in Adelaide, or, you know, doing 4 years and have a top trump card and be October
and...
Yeah, and a flat, yeah. You know, you never know, and the things that you think are going to lead you to the big time, in my experience, haven't. You never know, going for an audition or meeting the right people and getting on, and yeah, it was great, it was great.
So it was a completely different set of skills that you had to learn from Merlin than your ordinary acting
game. I mean, in terms of the writing, I did the sword fighting, I knew a bit from drama school because I did a lot of that, but it's very it's still very different. The sword fighting you do at some places at school is very, very different. And each kind of fighter you meet or fight coordinator teaches you different skills. But the horse riding was the thing that I really learned how to do, especially with stunt horses who are brilliant. So I did have to learn those skills, but and the fighting to make sure I didn't look stupid, didn't have a silly fight face.
Well, we have to wrap that up. You've been called away.
I can't believe it, yeah.
But Rupert, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, and I'm sorry it took me a while to get the lines right.
That's all right.
That's why you see Leo, never had many.
You'll turn up again in another one that we do outtakes on.
Okay, that's great. Brilliant. We got there and go, wow. You could have actually asked him more questions if you got it right. Yeah. Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Very sweet.
Hi, this is Rupert Young. And I did not play uncredited Roman soldier in Doctor Who. And you were listening to Women Talk Sci-Fi.
Well, that was a bit of fun, Jerry.
It was a bit of fun. It's all who. Not really.
It's the who's who, who's not in who.
It's the who's of who's not in who. You're absolutely right. But Rupert was very young, and we may someday use 2 minutes of the whole interview in a Merlin podcast.
You never know. So we'd like to thank Daniel from Supernova, who allowed us, along with Lionel Mitford from Lionel Mitford Publicity, to have the interview with Rupert.
And you'll be able to catch Daniel and Supernova Expos at www.supanova.com.au. And you'll find Lionel, who is a wonderful publicist and very, very, very good to us,
mm-hmm.
at lionelmitfordpublicity.com. He does lots of amazing shows.
Well, I think we better finish now.
I think you're right. I actually enjoyed the Rupert's interview very much when we did it because it was quite funny.
It was quite funny
to see her embarrassed, so to speak, as well. So it's always good when you can, go back and enjoy the moments you haven't had in life.
You just like seeing me being embarrassed.
But it was funny. It was funny. And he thought it was funny too.
He did think it was very funny. He did decide that he was going to find the person who impersonated him.
Because he could have a double. Because the guy did look like him. It looked... Because he being him went, yeah, it looks like me. So it's all fun.
So it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye for her. No, from her. To her. One of those things.
See ya.
See ya. Bye, bye.